Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, May 12th. I'm Lauren Schmidt reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, who killed Kate Madine? DNA breakthrough revives Humboldt Trinity cold case. Eureka's waterfront plan approved, but changes likely. And telephone landline service under threat again. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. Just before deadline, we received information regarding major funding from the state in Humboldt County. According to a press release from the Humboldt County Department of Health and Human Services, today, Monday, May 12th, Governor Gavin Newsom announced that Humboldt County has been awarded more than $43.5 million to build a new Semper Virens psychiatric health facility in Eureka. The funding comes from Proposition 1, the Behavioral Health Services Act, which voters passed in March 2024 to reform mental health care and expand treatment access, including for substance use and disorders. The new ADA-accessible facility will be located on 5th Street across from the Humboldt County Courthouse. It will span over 21,000 square feet and include 16 psychiatric health beds and 4 crisis stabilization beds, with expanded services for youth, non-ambulatory patients, and those in acute crisis. Health and Human Services Director Connie Beck called the project a critical step in building out the region's behavioral health system, stating, quote, "This new facility will make it possible for us to provide crisis stabilization and improved trauma-informed inpatient services in a more therapeutic environment than the current facility," close quote. The new Semper Virens facility is expected to be completed by 2030. You can see a rendering of the new building at kmud.org. One mystery has been solved, but many questions remain after Humboldt County identified a skull found on Trinidad Head in 1993 as belonging to a woman who disappeared in 1987. For more insight into the case and the ongoing investigation, KMUD News spoke with Humboldt County cold case investigator Deputy Mike Fridley, who shared background on the decades-old case, which began in the remote community of Hyampom in Trinity County nearly 40 years ago.
On August 3, 1987, Nicholas Madine reported his wife, Kay Josephine Madine, as a missing person to Trinity County Sheriff's Office. He had left on a business trip, and when he returned, she was gone. Trinity County Sheriff's Office searched the property, contacted families and friends, contacted her doctor. She had no serious medical issues, talked to her employer. She was a teacher at the Hyampom School, and that her boss said that she'd been in good spirits. Her personal property were found at the residence, and she was never located. And Trinity County took the missing person report and listed her disappearance as suspicious.
The case would go cold until the fall of that year, in November 1987.
The Humboldt County Sheriff's Office received a package in the U.S. mail containing skeletal remains and an anonymous letter giving directions to additional remains. Detectives followed those directions to a location near Ammon Ridge in eastern Humboldt County and identified more human remains. And this was not a complete body recovery. There were parts of the body that were not recovered.
Records confirmed that the remains belonged to the missing woman, officially shifting the case into a homicide investigation. But the case would again go cold without developments until the early 90s. However, the puzzle pieces wouldn't be put together until now.
So you move forward to February 16th, 1993. The Fortuna Police Department contacted the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office to report that a man had found a partial human skull on the beach near Trinidad Head. and the man turned the skull into Fortuna Police Department.
A traditional DNA profile was developed from the skull and entered into state and national databases. However, no match was ever made, and the case remained cold. That changed recently due to a grant aimed at clearing a backlog of unidentified human remains cases. Using those funds, the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office submitted the skull to Othram, a forensic lab in Texas specializing in advancing DNA technology.
In 2024, the Sheriff's Office was awarded a community project funding grant from Congressman Jared Huffman to work on a backlog of unsolved, recovered, identified human remains cases. So we sent the skull to a private lab named Othram in Texas. They were able to extract DNA from the skull, and they used forensic genome sequencing, and it gets into some technical stuff, but basically they use in-house genealogy, forensic genealogy, to produce investigative leads. In September 24, we received a report from Othram indicating the skull may be that of Kay Medine Adams. And the report included genetic relatives. I was able to track down her daughter. She agreed to give DNA, and I sent both of those samples to the Department of Justice, and they compared them and made the positive match that the skull that we had recovered had belonged to Kay Medine.
A follow-up investigation helped locate a possible relative, and the California Department of Justice confirmed a DNA match. But many unknowns remain, including the location of the rest of Kay Medine's remains, as her full skeletal structure has yet to be found. Another lingering mystery, who sent the anonymous typewritten letter to the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office, postmarked from the San Francisco area. While multiple reports note that her husband, Nicholas Medine, was away on business when she was last seen, only one article clearly states that he was not a suspect. KMUD News has not been able to confirm that with the Trinity County Sheriff's Office at the time of this report. And notably, Nicholas Medine died in 2018. Searching for more answers and historical context, we turned to archived reporting, where a report in the Reading Record Searchlight in the late 1980s quoted Trinity County Detective Sergeant Dave LaFrancini, who stated that foul play had been suspected early on. He did note, however, quote, "There was always a possibility that she left without telling anybody or didn't contact anybody, but it didn't seem likely," close quote. And Deputy Fridley agrees.
Her body was discovered, was in a very remote area and a long ways from her home. Her vehicle, I believe, was still at home, so that had been a long ways for her to walk and then decide to kill herself. I mean, it's possible, but the evidence leads towards this being a homicide.
As previously stated, the case became multi-jurisdictional across both Humboldt and Trinity counties when the Humboldt Sheriff's Office received that anonymous letter, further deepening the suspicion around her disappearance and death.
An anonymous typewritten letter with no, not anybody saying they're the one that did this or anything. So that's suspicious in itself, to get a letter that nobody put their name or anything on. And then when you follow the directions with the way they explained it, you find more remains. So that, again, makes things more suspicious.
Kay's skull was located more than 30 years ago. So we asked Deputy Fridley to share insight and why there was a delay in identification.
The sheriff's office has got probably, I think it's between 20 and 30, I don't know the exact number, cases of recovered unidentified human remains. Some of them we've recovered from 1968. We were able to identify that person. We have this backlog of unidentified remains that we have to hold on to. And this new technology with Othram using genetic genealogy has changed all that. They're able to use, there's certain genetic sites like Ancestry, GEDmatch, that allow, you could check the box to allow law enforcement to use your DNA, and it's used for, that's how we were able to track down the family members in all these cases.
And while we may now have answers about the identity of the remains, the case is far from solved, with more questions than answers still lingering.
It's not solved, but we've solved who the identity of the skull is. Yeah, anybody that has any information about Kay and her disappearance, to ask them to call me at 707-441-3024. No tips too small. This case is obviously very old, so it would take wouldn't take much to get it moving again.
Anyone with information regarding the disappearance or suspected homicide of Kay Josephine Medine of Higham Palm in the late 1980s is urged to contact investigator Mike Fridley at 707-441-3024. A photo of the former schoolteacher can be viewed at kmud.org. After many public meetings over the years, Eureka has approved a plan for developing its waterfront, with opportunity for amendments. KMUD's Daniel Mintz reports.
Years in development, the waterfront Eureka plan is now approved, but there's room for changing it as there's support for waiving minimum parking requirements in some of the plan's districts. The plan gained unanimous approval by the City Council at its May 6th meeting. Ultimate approval still waits, however, as the state's Coastal Commission will have to certify the plan as part of the city's Local Coastal Program, LCP. And as the council approached its vote on the plan's approval, there was talk of changing it to universally waive minimum parking requirements for residential development. During a public comment period, Colin Fisk of the Coalition for Responsible Transportation Priorities vouched for lifting the requirements throughout the plan area.
We are requesting a few modifications to the plan. One is to remove minimum parking mandates for new developments in the coastal zone and also in the inland parts of the city. Eureka's plans and policy documents acknowledge that these mandates are problematic and restrict new housing supply. And a number of years ago, Eureka led the way in loosening parking mandates and providing needed exceptions. Now it's just time to get rid of them altogether, as, for example, the city of Arcata is in the process of doing, and hundreds of other cities and counties and communities nationwide. There's no scientific basis for parking mandates, and their negative effects on housing production as well as walkability and pollution are well documented.
Jen Kalt of Humboldt Waterkeeper backed that up.
I would like to echo what Colin Fisk just said, and also would like to especially reinforce the idea of eliminating parking minimums. There's been a lot of study showing that this is the single policy that can make the biggest difference in increasing housing, new development. So in addition, you know, the parking lots cause a lot of stormwater pollution and, you know, require toxic pavement sealers and, you know, the cars parking there leak oil. And I think we could all agree that we probably don't want a lot of that along our waterfront on Humboldt Bay. So I hope you will consider eliminating the parking minimums altogether in the Eureka Waterfront Plan and adopt it tonight.
The plan waives parking requirements for residential projects within a half mile of transit stops, making most of the plan's 130-acre area exempt from the requirements. A commercial bayfront district and a portion of the district that includes the county library branch are the ones where the parking minimums would be in effect. But that and other changes can be made when the LCP is updated, as discussed in this exchange between Community Development Services Director Kristen Kenyon and Councilmember Leslie Castellano.
Currently, staff was planning on, with the LCP update, adopting what we have in the inland zoning code, which does still include parking ratios, although it has a lot of exceptions and reductions. So if council wants us to go a different direction, we're open to that.
Okay. I mean, you know, I do generally support you know, waiving parking requirements, you know, especially when so much of the planning area already will have them waived. You know, I think for consistency purposes, it would make sense just to extend that out. And generally, I'm in support of the recommendations made by the public commenters, and also understand that for some of them, we may need to wait for the LCP, and that's totally okay with me.
Councilmember Katie Moulton said the plan reflects, quote, the idea of having a really vibrant and inclusive old town that's got people living and working and shopping, and that's what makes it a place worth going to. Other notable aspects of the plan include its allowance of coastal-dependent uses like fishing and boating in bayfront areas, and its division of the bayfront into two districts. One reflects the mixed-use approach of Old Town, and the other is more varied, allowing larger development types such as RV parks. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
A suspect is in custody, accused of stealing tens of thousands of dollars worth of copper wiring. That's according to the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office, which shared details with local media this morning. But this suspect is no stranger to law enforcement at either the local or federal level. Lieutenant Jesse Taylor with the Sheriff's Office shares more.
Earlier this month, on the 1st, the Sheriff's Office received a call of a potential theft at a abandoned or vacated property in the Samoa area. One of our community services officers was dispatched to this location and learned that a significant amount of copper material, piping, wiring, et cetera, was obviously stolen from the location. And through his investigation, deputies were able to follow up on that information and identify a suspect, Brent John Holdridge from Arcata. And deputies were able to secure a search warrant for his residence in the 500 block of Warren Creek Road in Arcata. Upon serving that search warrant, not all of, but a good portion of the property that was stolen from the theft site was recovered. As many people know, copper right now is very expensive, and so that was probably some of the motivating factors when Mr. Holdridge allegedly committed this theft. I say that because everybody's presumed innocent until proven guilty, but we did recover property at his residence, and then he was subsequently booked into the Humboldt County Jail for burglary, grand theft, and possession of stolen property.
Original reporting by Kim Kemp of Redheaded Black Belt reveals that the suspect, Brent Holdridge, was also identified as a participant in the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol, a violent attempt to stop the certification of the presidential election results. According to Kemp's report at KimKemp.com, Holdridge self-surrendered and faced multiple federal charges, including entering and remaining in a restricted building or grounds, disorderly and disruptive conduct in a restricted area, disorderly conduct in a Capitol building, parading, demonstrating, or picketing inside the Capitol. Each of these charges carries a potential sentencing ranging from 6 months to 1 year in jail. On January 20th, 2025, Holdridge became one of more 1,500 individuals granted clemency by President Donald Trump, who issued a sweeping pardon for those convicted in connection to the Capitol riot. Locally, Lieutenant Taylor stated that the suspect's federal history was not a factor in the current copper theft case, but noted that the suspect had a criminal history spanning nearly two decades in Humboldt County.
I can confirm that Mr. Holdridge is known to us going back to 2008, 2010. I'm just looking at some history with matters that he was involved in. I specifically, or the Sheriff's Office, does not have any confirmation on those rumors that he was associated with the January 6th. Incident at the Capitol.
And while the Sheriff's Office stated it hasn't confirmed a direct link, FBI Special Agent Randall Watts of the Eureka Field Office confirmed those key details in an interview with our media partner. Notably, Holdridge is not the first January 6 rioter who was later pardoned, only to be arrested again on new unrelated charges. Among others, a Florida man arrested on federal gun charges, a Texas man charged with solicitation of a minor, one individual sentenced to 10 years for a fatal DUI, and another was shot and killed by Indiana police during a traffic stop. Holdridge joins a growing list of capital attackers who made headlines post-pardon. And given his past and the apparent risk of reoffending, Lieutenant Taylor acknowledged that this case highlights a broader systemic issue.
Yeah, so we live in a state and in a time where rehabilitation has been the focus of habitual offenders, and the 25 or so years that I've been in law enforcement, I don't know that it's been all that successful, obviously, with a lot of the repeat offenders that people see and read about. There is a fine line between rehabilitation and being accountable for your own actions, and I think that's something that the criminal justice system struggles with at times. And that's not to say that I think that everybody should go to jail and we throw away the key and never see you again. I think there is a lot of valid reasons as to why the rehabilitation process needs to be investigated. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of people in the community that are just quite frankly fed up with having to see and, be re-victimized time and time again by these folks who really don't have any consequence to their actions. And so with that in mind, unfortunately, you're seeing what we see now with a lot of people, being habitual criminals with very little accountability on their end.
In closing, Lieutenant Taylor commended the diligent work of the community services officer in resolving the case and reiterated that the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office remains committed to protecting residents from property crimes.
Really happy that we have those positions. Some of those are funded by Measure Z. Again, they're essential service positions that allow a CSO to take a lot of the workload off of our deputy sheriffs who are responding to in-progress emergencies. So just a really important position, and I'd like to highlight that.
Anyone with information about this case or related criminal activity is encouraged to contact the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office at 707-445-7251. Turning to Mendocino and beyond, the California Public Utilities Commission is considering changes to long-standing rules that require certain telephone companies to provide landline service to everyone in their designated coverage areas. That's raising alarm in rural communities where many residents say landlines are still the only reliable connection to the outside world. KZYX's Elise Cox shares this report.
Michael Maffei, a county resident who lives about 3 miles inland from the Pacific Ocean, received a notice about the PUC rulemaking in March. And while the language was deliberately neutral and procedural, Maffei wasn't fooled.
AT&T is trying to drop the landlines, and that's the only communication I have with the outside world, period. And I'm in my 80s, and I have another guy that's 56 that's legally blind, and it's his only way, too. He lives on the property. He's been here for 15 years.
Maffei is concerned that not enough people who are affected will raise their voices to ensure that the carrier of last resort rules continue to include landlines. In many areas of Mendocino County, there is no reliable cell phone service, including neighborhoods near Jackson State Demonstration Forest and Casper Forest, where Maffei lives.
There's a whole dead zone between Casper and Mendocino. There's just no cell service, period. So the landlines are real important for emergency vehicles and stuff, if I want to call 911.
And they're also important, I would imagine, for just basic everyday communication. I reached you today to set up the interview via the landline.
Correct.
Maffei is urging people to write letters to the California Public Utilities Commission and explain how important it is to preserve access to landlines. You can provide comments through the CPUC website.
Residents across the North Coast are already weighing in through public comments, many sharing firsthand concerns. One comment from Southern Humboldt reads, quote, I live in Shelter Cove and cannot get cell reception at my house. I am 80 years old, and my landline is my only way to communicate with family, friends, and doctors. I had to make 4 911 calls in 2024 and 2005. Life-saving, literally. Please don't get rid of necessary phone communication. It would make my life extremely difficult. Close quote. A Mendocino County resident from Point Arena echoed similar worries. Quote, I can hardly believe I have to comment again on this. I live in a remote, rural location where cell service is poor to non-existent, and internet phone service is unreliable. Power outages happen multiple times a year, and my landline always works. Claims that we're adequately served by other options are false. This is about public and personal safety. Close quote. Again, the CPUC's public hearing on the proposed changes is scheduled for tomorrow, Tuesday, May 13th, with sessions at 2 p.m. and 6 p.m. You can find links to submit a public comment and access hearing details at KMUD.org. In national news, mothers hold 24-hour vigil in D.C. to protest Republican cuts to Medicaid. Kennedy Cuello reports.
Democratic lawmakers joined hundreds of mothers in a rally to fight against Medicaid cuts. It comes as a new report from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates millions of Americans would lose Medicaid coverage under current Republican budget proposals. The CBO report said, under each of those options, Medicaid enrollment would decrease and the number of people without health insurance would increase. House Republicans are looking to slash as much as $1.5 trillion in cuts across federal government health, food stamp, and other social safety net programs to offset the revenue lost for some $4.5 trillion in tax breaks, largely for the wealthy. Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi of San Francisco emphasized that these cuts will hurt the most vulnerable to benefit others.
How can they possibly say we're going to take hundreds of billions of dollars from Medicaid that helps our children to give a tax break to the richest people in America, as they did when they had the majority in the White House before, 83% of the benefits going to the top 1%.
A 24-hour vigil outside Congress was also underway, calling on Republican lawmakers to scrap proposed cuts to Medicaid. Democratic Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts called the fight a moral one during the vigil, saying that this is about benefiting certain financial interests, not saving money.
You know, we are joined together by a moral purpose at a moral moment to defend Medicaid and the people we love from a Republican budget that is cruel by design. The cruelty is the point. A budget that would rip $880 billion from Medicaid, not to save money, but to bankroll tax cuts for Donald Trump and Elon Musk's billionaire friends.
Medicaid recipients, including people with diabetes, service providers, and advocates, spoke throughout the night and told stories of people who rely on Medicaid's life-saving programs. Democratic Senator of Minnesota, Amy Klobuchar, applauded the 24-hour vigil. She called it a powerful display, acknowledging the need for Medicaid, saying that it showed that Medicaid is a 24/7 type of thing.
People who are on Medicaid, it's not just a passing moment for them, it's their whole lives. Their lives depend on Medicaid. So by making the point, by going around 24 hours, when it's dark, when it's light, you make that point that they need Medicaid now and they need it 24 hours a day.
House Speaker Republican Mike Johnson of Louisiana aims to pass a bill to codify cuts to Medicaid by Memorial Day. More moderate Republicans in contested congressional districts are warning they won't vote for steep Medicaid cuts. For KPFA News, I'm Kennedy Cuello.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez. And thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Kennedy Cuello, and Elise Cox. KMUD News is online. You can find us on KMUD.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms. You can also follow us on social media. If you have suggestions or questions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send us an email to news@KMUD.org. Reporting for KMUD in Redway, I'm Lauren Schmidt.